General Government and Subcommittee of Ways and Means. Hopefully we can start the hearing rolling, and our other members will begin to show up. Dallas, where were we at?
Okay. Mr. Chair, we have today the Procurement, Fleet, and Surplus Services Division. This was the division that formerly had a longer name, but they moved the printing and distribution function to Information Resources Management Division, and so it is now Procurement, Fleet, and Surplus Services Division. And we have Cam Burney, the Division Director, with us, and Cora Parker from Budget and Management.
Good morning, Mr. Burney. Nice to see you. And I'm sorry the rest of the members of the committee aren't here yet, but why don't you go ahead and begin?
Okay. Probably for show, well, actually for reality, our division is so acronym-laden that I'll try to avoid, but right now, knowing that I'll slip up occasionally, I'll do the big, a little bit of a favor. I can even get this thing in.
We're going to use that to balance the budget at the end.
Okay.
Thanks, Cam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Cam Burney. I administer, as Dallas indicated, the Procurement, Fleet, and Surplus Services Division. We contain three major programs, and as far as an overview is concerned, the first one would be the Fleet Administration and Motor Pool Program, which have different identities. Fleet Administration is basically statutorily authorized to oversee the conduct of all state fleets, whether it's motor pool or otherwise. The motor pool itself provides about 4,000 general purpose vehicles statewide to state agencies as well as local governments. It services these vehicles either through contractors or through its own sites. It dispenses fuel at its own sites, the sites being in Salem, Portland, and a new site at Springfield, which replaces the older site in Eugene. And it basically coordinates all state-owned vehicle activity. The state and federal surplus property programs are, as they seem, not real property, but personal property. The state program brings in property from state agencies as well as participating local governments and sells these properties on the behalf of those agencies. The federal surplus property program, located at the same warehouse, which is out on Salem Industrial Park Road, brings in surplus or underused property from the federal sector and does the same thing, making these properties available to state agencies, political subdivisions, and if it can't otherwise be sold to other audiences, including the general public. Procurement, the Office of State Procurement basically directs all procurements that are exceed $75,000, and it sets guidelines up, rules relating to how other agencies will conduct their purchasings under $75,000. It establishes statewide high-volume contracts for the benefit of all state agencies and local governments, and we'll get into that later on when we talk about performance measures and some of the successes. And more recently, it is engaged very actively in a statewide training and certification program for purchasing officials to bring them up to speed with certain standards. Get used to these buttons here. The mission of the agency, mission of the division, is to improve government by providing services that are best managed centrally. We have a central focus, and by bringing in and consolidating, in, as I will explain in the future, certain of the operations, we provide a lower cost and higher responsiveness. Goals go hand in hand with the mission of basically serve customers well, earn credibility. Organizational chart. This is quite the change, as and I think you were given a preview of this several days ago, of the organization 0103 with 265 positions, which included the publishing and distribution section, to the 0305, which has 118 positions and 116.80 FTEs. And we'll get to the particular packages later on in the presentations, Chair. Service delivery. Service basically is provided either on-site through telephone or in-person consultations, or more and more electronically through electronic access to price agreements, through electronic bidding on surplus property, through electronic arranging for servicing of vehicles. I provided on this page a history of legislative interest and activity, just to mention to the members of the committee or the member of the subcommittee, the activity and interest that has taken place in at every biennium of the past decade and up to through this decade, relating to, first of all, requiring the biennial evaluation of the performance of all state fleets, and that report is taken biennially to the Joint Legislative Audits Committee. And in fact, just a few months ago, we did make a presentation. Asking us in 95 to solicit bids from private sector firms to operate some portions of the motor pool in Portland, which we did, but that particular resulting statute was repealed in about 2 years later. And then to ensure, in 1997, ensure that all state-owned vehicles are driven more than a certain number of miles per month as established by rule. And then finally, and we'll get into this today too, in 2001, there was created a Senate Interim Task Force on State-Owned Vehicle Efficiency, chaired by Senator Clarno, that determined those circumstances under which it might be better to pursue private sector vehicle rentals rather than motor pool rentals.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, you have a copy of Senator Clarno's task force report to the Senate President in front of the Biden.
Okay. And I don't know how much President Butler wanted to get into that. I think that may be a policy question that might be answered elsewhere. Well, I don't know. That's my opinion.
Okay. I've kind of gone through these already in my previous chats. Factors affecting services, which are at the federal level, these are federal influences. The Energy Policy Act of 1992 directs that state governments shall purchase a certain number of vehicles, alternative fuel vehicles, every year. The numbers have been increasing. So we have that mandate upon us as it is on all states, and within a year or so it's going to be hitting city governments as well. So we have to deal with that reality. There are two circulars coming out of the Office of Management and Budget. A76 was a key circular that basically guides federal agencies and state agencies and local agencies which wish to use it on how to determine whether a private sector offer, how to compare that, using what criteria, compare it with an in-government offer, such as motor pool. It could be anything. So that was a key set of guidelines was used in Senator DeCarno's committee. Office of Management Budget Circular A87 relates to monies received by the motor pool from agencies that are federally funded, and severe restrictions relating to how much earnings can be retained for vehicle replacement. Relates to how to fund fleet expansion. And it's a budgetary factor, as Dallas does know, because we occasionally do get penalized in rather large amounts because of the way we are funded. State and federal surplus property are guided by numerous federal surplus property eligibility requirements. And procurement, we're guided somewhat and assisted somewhat by an Electronic Government Act of 2002, which with me today is Dugan Petty, my deputy administrator, who can come forth as needed to explain, perhaps not now, but as needed to talk about how this has benefited, this can benefit state agencies. On to page 11. Some interagency and intergovernmental activity. This division has been very much involved in the sustainability initiative prompted by the sustainability order issued by Governor Kitzhaber in 2000, as well as by the 2001 passage of House Bill 3948, which created the State Sustainability Board. Even though it's not funded currently, it still continues to meet, and we tend to interact with them. Very healthy program, the Oregon Cooperative Purchasing Program, is a union of local governments working with state government purchasing to pool their buying powers and to come up with resulting very good prices. We'll get to that more in a while. Western States Contracting Alliance is a step beyond that, where it's a purchasing of volumes beyond state and local governments to include multi-states. And we have specific areas where we buy through multi-state contracts, including personal computers, where we really benefit price-wise. And then another interagency situation, reality is our law in the state purchasing law relating to qualified rehabilitation facilities. There is an acronym here that's used more often than that name, and since I put my $5 in, I'll mention that QRF is the acronym many people know them by rather than the name. And this is a section that provides certain bidding opportunities to organizations that employ persons with disabilities. And this has been, in recent sessions, this has been a very active area for discussion in this committee and others. Administrative cost controls. Basically, first of all, the two bullets relate to a couple of steps to control costs. In the past 10 years, we have, through consolidation primarily, and then some expanded demand, we have brought other state agency fleets into our own. So we've gone from approximately 1,700 to about 4,000 vehicles in the motor pool. Also, there has been a shutdown of most agency fueling sites in the Salem area, so that we have the big one now in Salem where we service not only many state, all state agencies, but many local governments in the Salem area. And that's been cost control matter for many agencies. We've also cooperated with many agencies to reduce duplication and minimize costs in high-volume price agreements, intergovernmental surplus sales, where we sell surplus property on behalf of state of local governments. And I yield to Ms. Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Can we just stop for just a second before you go through there? Can we talk a little bit? Can we talk a little bit about when we talk about purchasing? I understand that you belong to the Western States Contracting Alliance and other things. Can we talk maybe a little bit more about how DAS is setting the standards for state agencies? Because some of these purchasing alliances have, from soup to nuts within the items that somebody may buy. And I guess my question is, what kind of standards is DAS setting? I'm more specifically concerned about IT stuff, but I mean, what kind of standards does DAS set for state agencies in terms of, what needs to be bought, interoperability of equipment, software standard, those kinds of things. And I know we can talk with IRMD to some extent about the IT stuff, but I was wondering in other areas of state government.
Mr. Chair, if I could have that question fielded by Dugan Petty, Deputy Administrator of the Division.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Dugan Petty, Deputy Administrator of the Division, as Cam has mentioned. The two Western States Contracting Alliance contracts that we have that involve information technology are contracts for PCs and then also wireless contracts. And maybe I can kind of talk a little bit about how those contracts came about, a little bit about the structure, which I think is important to understanding this. The state of Oregon some years ago looked at the proposition of joining, they were members of the Western States Contracting Alliance. The state of New Mexico took the lead. That contracting alliance decided to bid for personal computers, information technology. The state of New Mexico took the lead, and they crafted a procurement document that was bid in a way that asked, that was intended to be multiple awards, and ask for a product line. And that's not uncommon in the way that many states bid things, including Oregon, where you get access to the product line and then you get pricing on that product line. So we had signed up as potential participants in that procurement. And we evaluated that procurement after the awards were open. And we evaluated it in a number of ways. We wanted to see how the pricing compared to us, and we also wanted to think about it in terms of impact to local suppliers. And what we found in that initial evaluation was that we were getting, that opened up a product line which was essentially the same product line that we had available to us, but at deeper discounts than anything we could touch by aggregating all of Oregon's buying power. So as a result of that, we did participating addendums. And I don't believe we signed up for all of them, but we wound up with contracts with Compaq, which is now HP, Compaq, Dell, Gateway, and IBM. And the way those were structured was a percentage discount off of the product line. And on top of that, one of the very good benefits, I believe, for all the political subdivisions of the state as well as us, is that the discount continued to increase with the amount of volume that were purchased off of those contracts. And right now they're at $2.6 billion. So we're getting dynamite pricing. Now let's talk about the standards issue. Because we opened up a product line back about 4 years ago, it allowed agencies to make decisions at that point about whether they believed that a compact made sense or HP made sense, and we didn't require them to buy specific configurations. It is possible within those contracts, and many of the CIOs in the other agencies, we know last session when we had this discussion, have standardized around configurations that meet their needs within their agencies and have said, all right, we want a basic, an intermediate, and a high-end desktop configuration. And they've actually gone back to the Dells and to the HPs and to the gateways that have that and said, if we buy 300 around the standard configuration, will you give us a deeper discount? And in fact, they've driven even deeper discounts yet. So there is some standardization that's taken place at an agency level to not be not buy different pieces for the desktop because it's a nightmare to integrate. So there's some of that that's taken place, but we haven't, from the purchasing position, said we will only buy an HP, for example. We haven't taken that step around standardization. Is that
But I guess also, what about the communications between various departments? If DAS is going out and buying 300 and DHS is going out and buying 100 and the legislature is buying, I mean, I know the legislature is different, but I mean, somebody else is buying, you know.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's an excellent question, and I don't think we have a purchasing solution to that question, and it's not that we shouldn't be part of that solution. We've provided an array of very effective buying tools. Agencies have consolidated, and unfortunately some have consolidated around gateways, for example. Some have consolidated around Dells. And our own agency is now buying HPs. I mean, we were using Dells. Those decisions are made by the technology experts within those agencies. And in some cases, you have such an embedded line of computers that it may not make sense to go to one. So I hope that answers your question.
Senator Devil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you said that they were buying at discount, was it discount from an agreed-upon sort of pricing system for the line, or is it a discount from what current portions of the line are selling for, in the sense of, I mean, something that comes out that's very fast will have a premium price on it for the first year or so, and then the price will drop dramatically?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, you're exactly right. The way this is structured is that it is a discount off of their government pricing list, and that discount gets higher based on the volumes of purchases. So to the extent that a computer company brings out the latest, fastest chip with the latest, fastest memory, and they do establish a higher premium for that, then we pay something less than that based on that percentage discount that would apply. But eventually, those lines go down or something else replaces that. I think that many agencies, I know our own included, aren't out there buying the biggest screen, the fastest computer. They're really trying to say, what is it that meets the needs of the agency here? I mean, if you don't need all that high power, then why do it? So I think there is some. I think all the CIOs I've ever talked about are trying to operate at what best serves their needs.
Thank you.
I'm just trying to get an understanding. So there is no real standards that DAS is setting, and we can talk about. You know, I've watched around the Capitol. I've seen a proliferation of flat screens that may or may not be necessary within the bounds of this particular building, that are substantially more expensive, that are substantially, you know, and I guess without setting some without setting some statewide standards and having some controls on departments. I guess that is a concern. Chair means
I think that might be better suited for IRMD next week, Monday, because by law they've got the responsibility for setting those standards. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Gary Weeks. Thanks to the Director of the Department of Administrative Services. And I also appreciate your question because I'm very interested in us addressing the standards question across state government. With regard to the legislature, we, of course, don't have any authority to set standards for you. Would be willing to consider that, but I'm not sure your members would agree to that. So when IRMD gets here, we can explore this more. But I guess just for the record, I want the members here to know that I'm very interested in that. It's not only standards in the hardware, the acquisition of hardware, but also the software and the compatibility and issues and so on that we've not. We've been, I think my own folks have heard me say this, more democratic maybe than we should have over the years in letting people have more choice and so on like that. And to some extent, because there's, you know, Dell operating systems and Compact and so on are basically the same. You know, we can make that work. It's really the software that we get into greater challenges and the way the networks operate that we get into greater challenges and stuff.
I'm hoping gas will become more benevolently dictatorial at some point in time.
Chairman, that's the move right now.
I realize that, Gary, and I certainly appreciate that. I also wonder, too, I guess my concern is, though, that IRMD can set standards, but it's a matter of, I mean, we have, you know, I work for a multi-facility organization that the central office is located in Oregon, and the other outlying facilities are located in other states, and we're not there on the ground. And we certainly set standards, but really, unless they go through our central purchasing, we don't catch a lot of, you know, we don't have the ability to catch a lot of those items. And so I guess maybe the thrust of my question should be more along the lines of, do you have procedures in place in your purchasing division to make sure that they are meeting the standards? I guess is more along the lines of maybe to crystallize my question, because that's what we have found, is that we have a bunch of cowboys out there on occasion doing their own thing, and unless it's coming through a centralized purchasing that you really have the ability to make some controls and ask the questions and say, are you really meeting the standards that have been set, or are you exceeding them or falling below them? I guess can you maybe answer what kind of controls you put in place for those things
that have standards on? Can someone go out and buy large purchases like these off contract and we wouldn't know about it?
Well, we know about after the fact. They don't have to come to us for prior approval. The CIOs, the purchasing people, and business officers from agencies, we don't make up the specifications out of the blue. They provide us, Mr. Chair, what they want to see, what they want us to buy, the specifications. Mm-hmm. We funnel those into, and those are reflected in the bid specification. But beyond that, we are not normally in a police. We aren't in a policing role.
I guess that remains my concern. Is there's no catch basin by which we can make sure that,
except after the fact, where we go, aha.
Well, but then the money's spent.
Yeah. Dugan, do you want to add to this?
I think so. Mr. Chairman, in some circumstances where there is really a standard that's been established, and sometimes it's by virtue of the specification that we established, and that is what gets purchased. And we get tremendous buying power off of that, and we require agencies to buy off it. So it's not like everything is set up without standards. When it comes to information technology, and this part of it has just been what's evolved. I mean, there's been a great proliferation of different things, and because there have not been standards to date, we found that the best way to get the agencies what they needed in the democratic kind of place that Director Weeks has spoken of has been to get the best buying power we can, and we have done that. Now, it's my understanding that the CIOs, which has been the CIO Council, which has been convened by IRMD, is actually developing standards. Once those standards have been developed, and the experts in the IT area come back to us and say, we've landed on a standard, we can take those WISCA agreements and our participating addendums that engage us in that contract can be written in such a way that we narrow our involvement to those things that are consistent with the standard. So certainly the capability is there, but first the standards have to be set.
But let me get maybe a clearer understanding then of what you're doing, because I've never sat on this subcommittee before. Let me get a more clear understanding of what you do. It sounds like you're more of a facilitator than anything else to get government contracts. And I guess maybe a more simplified question is, how often does somebody submit requests for purchasing for your department and you send it back saying you don't meet the you're not meeting the standard, whether it be, you know, just as an example, I'll give you out of our own company. We did kind of a survey of, you know, five or six things that we know are purchased by all facilities to get pricing on it, because we didn't have before we had centralized purchasing. Because we run healthcare facilities, just for rubber gloves, we had facilities paying 10% of what other facilities were paying. We had huge, huge cost differences. Not that it's a huge amount of money every year. It is a lot in a healthcare facility, but it's enough to make, you know, 30 days worth of difference in keeping people in beds. And so I guess that's my question is, you know, whether it's, you know, two-ply or one-ply toilet paper. You know, I don't know what the standards are, but I'm wondering how often do you centralize the things and you reject some of those things by sending them back to state agencies.
Mr. Chairman, toilet paper was probably a pretty good case in point. We have established a standard specification. We have established a standard contract for that, and that is the contract. That's the mandatory contract. And for the most part, agencies are pretty good if we hit that standard right to buy off of that. On occasion, we'll get agencies to come in because by rule we say if that's not going to meet your need, you can come into us and we will look at your request and we'll allow you to go someplace else if we really can't meet it and there's good value there. We do that in large part because we establish a contract with the supplier that says we agree to buy all of these things for you in return for your best pricing, and so we have an obligation to fulfill there to drive the best bargain we can. But I can't give you off the top of my head the number of times that we've approved that or denied an agency coming in to ask to buy off a contract, but it does happen.
Okay. And just so I get an understanding of your process, they buy off of contract. Do you see those? Do they process it through DAS when they purchase, or is it decentralized to the agency? So really, unless you go in and do an audit of an agency, you really won't discover whether they're buying on or off contract. I guess that's my next question.
Let me give you kind of a picture that we have probably about 900 some contracts in play at any given time.
Right.
And these are contractual agreements, like for our Boise Cascade office supplies. With Boise Cascade, we have a full line of office supplies, electronic ordering system, and that is a contract. Mm-hmm. And so public agencies, state agencies, as well as ORCAP members, have access to buy off of that contract. We don't have a supply system where everybody sends a requisition in and then an ordering position in DAS and some central organization would then go out and call the contractor up and order. We establish the contracts, and our instructions are for the agencies that when they need to buy office supplies, that they buy them off of that Boise contract. And we don't have a mechanism in place to go around and audit each and every one of those to make sure that all of their purchases are purchased off of that contract. But by and large, I think they're pretty good at that. Because what happens with those contracts is we drive pretty good pricing. And they're fairly hard to beat. And we try to set up convenience with them so agencies want to come to them and use them as opposed to being...
Okay, but I understand, and maybe the Boise contract's a good example. You know, we sign a statewide Boise contract, but the Boise catalog, you can buy from soup to nuts. You can buy the Chevy to the Mercedes Benz. And I guess does DAS ever go in and ask Boise to kick out by product? I mean, I would imagine DAS could ask Boise to kick out by product code how many of X, Y, and Z widgets we purchased, and be able to
have some evaluation of. Is one department of state government buying the Mercedes-Benz of this, and is there a justification versus, you know, versus the base model Chevy with air conditioning? And I guess that's my question. I mean, I went downstairs, just as an example, when I came here this time. I went downstairs. I ordered a universal power supply backup system. They didn't have the one that I bought for my other computer at home that I could buy at Circuit City for $39. That was the, they didn't have that particular model, so the only model that was available to me was the $159 model that was in the Boise catalog, and they have the $159 all the way up to the $500. So I guess I'm asking, and you've answered my question, we're not going in to really look at state agencies to see if they're buying the base model Chevy versus the Cadillac. Is that a correct? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think that that's correct.
But I think that is correct. This pen is a good example of
right.
A pencil. You can buy a standard one that has no rubber on the bottom and doesn't flick from the deal, and it just rolls down, and they're about probably 19, 20 cents a piece. You can buy this, or you can buy an all-metal one.
Right.
We don't say you have to buy that 19, 20 cent one or the all-metal one. So you're right. There is opportunity for agencies to make decisions about that.
I'd be and just for you, Director Weeks, and your purchasing. I mean, I'd be interested, like in your in the state contacting Boise to say, can we tickle out, because it's already in their computer database, what we're buying by product category, and maybe having you guys take a look at it. I know it takes some time, but. Every extra $150 at in this day and age really counts and means a lot.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one thing I should tell you is I've already had some conversations with the audits division about some focused audits that I'd like to have done in the next year. One of them is around purchasing practices, and there are several others that I gave them a list of, and they seem to be willing to change their agenda a little bit to focus on some of the things that we want to find out about, agency behaviors and stuff. So.
And I don't want to send the message either that I want generic state government, that everyone has to have XYZ number two pencils and that's all they get and this, that, and the other thing. I understand the flexibility and need to be flexible, and I don't want to send that message back, but it is good to, I always think it is fruitful to go back and look at some of those things, and when you have a Boise database or something else that's relatively, I would imagine is relatively, not simple, but relatively accessible, I guess is a better word to use, on a quarterly basis or whatever. That way you can help get some controls under and provide some leadership.
Representative Patridge.
Senator Winters, I'm sorry for preaching today.
Well, that's quite all right, because,
sometimes I feel like I'm so chronologically advantaged. I remember things when General Services was responsible for negotiating contracts and the overriding principle for governmental agencies was that you looked at what was the most efficient and economic way of purchasing. We did not have a huge catalog that we could go shopping up and down, because what was inside that catalog were those items that were more reasonable to purchase. And I think in this kind of climate, when we're talking about the economies and talking about budget, I think it really we really do need to look at that, which brings up another issue, because it used to be you could tell when a public vehicle was on the road. Now you cannot tell if there's a public vehicle on the road, and so unless you look at that e-license plates or something, and that doesn't really mean that they're state license plates.
No.
So do we no longer designate on our autos, or do we still designate on our autos where they're state autos?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we do have our vehicles, with a few exceptions, the ones that are specifically unmarked and have gone through a process to achieve the unmarking, have e-plates. All motor pool vehicles and other agency-owned vehicles are e-plated unless they go through the Department of Administrative Services and meet certain criteria laid out in the rule, or unless they are permitted by their own state laws, such as the state police, to have a certain number be unmarked. Currently, we have, I believe it's 116 vehicles within our own, under our control, are unmarked vehicles and used by criminal justice, primarily criminal justice purposes, Department of Justice, and elsewhere. So it's a minority, and we screen them very, very carefully.
But now it's follow-up. Because the fleets are pretty much, I'm assuming, I could be wrong, that you have one purchaser that most of them all will have DAS on it rather than the agency, except for those exceptions where the agency has purchased their own vehicle.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, all state-owned vehicles are required to have the agency, owning agency name on it. So you'd see Department of Transportation, in certain cases, you see state police and whatnot. But where you see an unmarked car, you won't have any idea what the owning agency is. And that's it goes hand in hand. It's unmarked. Did that answer your question?
If I wanted to access a vehicle out at Motor Pool, what's the designation on that vehicle?
Designation would be an E-plate vehicle.
Well, E-plate just means public vehicle. That's
public
not what
vehicle.
I'm getting at.
And also, if I may,
okay.
Go ahead. On the bumper, there's also, it says Department of Administrative Services.
That's State Motor Pool.
So whether my agency is Human Services, if I go through Motor Pool, that has a DAS on the back. That's where
exactly.
I was going.
Exactly.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to belabor this cost thing, but I was reminded by your comment about the being able to go to Office Depot, and this has troubled me for years as an agency head, because you will be able to find sales different places and different days that are going to beat our prices. And as Cam knows, I've complained about this when I wore other hats and stuff, but the rationale for the way we do business is, yeah, sure, you may be able to go down on Saturday and get a special at Office Depot that beats our prices. But on balance, what we negotiate and our contracts is going to be on balance better than you can get on any given day. And so it's one of the things
the temporary chair acknowledges that is the case. My issue was is it was a product that was it was just a product that was unavailable in the Boise catalog,
mm-hmm.
that was more than adequate to meet the need that I knew about. So I went and said, I'm going to buy this thing, got an exception here instead of going through the Boise catalog, and did that. So I understand, and I also understand within your rules you have some flexibility, and I'm not going to hold you to Fry's and Best Buy and Office Depot standard and off the dock fire sale kind of thing. I understand that you got to set standards, and sometimes that price is higher than what you're going to get on the barn burner sale price, and sometimes most of the time it is going to be lower, and I appreciate and understand that, and understand why you set standards and enter into those contracts. And that's why I said I don't want to say, because we're in government, we have to have a green visor and a yellow pencil and a white pad of paper. That's not appropriate either. I appreciate the fact that you do have some flexibility in your standards, but in terms of capturing those I'm just trying to say I'd like to see us focus on capturing costs. I know, Gary, you're open to new ideas.
Right.
And the Boise thing that I just mentioned to you is, in my opinion, something that my company has done and other companies I know have done to go look at those things.
Mm-hmm. A glimpse of the future, if I may, Dugan is running, and very soon we'll have electronic ordering where we'll be able to block out items.
Yeah. So no, that's why I said it's important. I think Senator Devlin has a question.
Well, I just wanted to make a short statement in the sense, I guess sometimes what this perception comes from is individual experiences, and I don't claim any particular expertise in information technology other than a layperson's expertise, but when I came into the legislature in 97, that was the first session that they permitted legislators to buy PCs from their own accounts. And you could only buy under the state contract. You could not buy out on the street, because obviously they did not want 14 different varieties of PCs up here. But the total system that I bought, which was a small HP laser printer, relatively medium speed for what was available at the time, PC, and software, including network software, came to about, I think, about $2,600. I could have gone down to Computer USA and probably bought virtually the same thing, except it wouldn't have been Tangent. It would have been Compaq or that, for probably about $1,600. And it's those kind of like anecdotal stories that start these kinds of concerns. And I guess those are the kinds of things that they end up in newspapers and they end up coming back to people like Representative Patridge. Those are the kinds of things that they develop sort of a reputation that's hard to overcome. Mm-hmm. It's not quite as bad as the $900 toilet seats, but it's still not good.
Well, I just wanted to add to that. I mean, it's not just the state purchasing system, but you see the anecdotes are in the paper about the federal system as well, talking about we pay more for screwdrivers in the governmental system than you do if you're just down to the public to go someplace. And I think we have to be cognizant, very cognizant now, of the public perception and how we're entering into our procurement agreements with the companies. If something is costing three times more than what John Q. Public would pay for it, that becomes a major issue out there. And I would just encourage you, because there is this and some of it, I say perception, but there's also some actual issues that some things are there. And I just say, just get cognizant of it.
And maybe to the agency's defense and government's defense in total, I work for a large company that does purchasing. We have multi-facilities. I happen to run the IT shop, as many of you know, with a pretty significant network, multi-state network. And I get the same thing from my facility administrators. Why do we have to buy X computer that you've standardized us on? Because, you know, I walk down to the Best Buy or Fry's or whatever and buy it for cheaper. Well, they can't because they're not getting the same thing, and we can't support it. We've got standard configurations that we push software through, that we main virus updates, that we do all those kinds of things. So I defend you when I can, as long as you do your best and most diligent efforts to do what you do, and I think that that's all we can expect in state government. So for those of you who haven't been out in the private sector to deal with that or deal within large corporate organizations, you face the same thing that you face every time you come to the legislature, as well as fighting the public perception. So, as you know, I appreciate and realize those concerns, and it is a difficult perception. I don't think it is overcomable in some cases. So, just wear large, thicker asbestos
as you come.
Say the devil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to make another short statement in terms of everybody functions from personal experience. And even though this experience almost goes back as far as Senator Winter's experiences, I have been under really bad procurement systems that are so specific, so cumbersome, so difficult that people avoid them. I mean, I can remember back almost now over a quarter of a century. repairing electronic equipment for the military, and because we were under an administration that time that did not want to let us have anything actually available in the field, and everything had to be ordered, and it would take, 90 days to get a simple diode that you'd need, of just deciding to go down to what was then the equivalent of the local Radio Shack and buying the diode on the open market, because to go through the system would have taken forever and probably would have cost a fortune in terms of what the, for a 49-cent diode. And so you can go to extremes, too, in trying to control everything that an individual employee does or an individual section does, which I'm sure you recognize, and you probably had more experience with that than I've ever had.
Now that we have pontificated and belabored and shared our battle stories and everything else, I certainly appreciate it. But if you would get to us to some extent as to what kind of controls you have after the fact, I'd be interested in getting some of those items, what you're looking at, after the fact in purchasing, so we can really look at those things. Because I really see you as the, I really see you, unfortunately, as being policing state government to some extent. Because, like I said earlier, you set a lot of standards, but oftentimes those standards don't get followed. So I'd be interested in just the controls, and we can talk offline about it. Not today. We probably should get to Cora here pretty relatively quickly, unless people have anything else to add.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Nice to see you this morning.
Nice to see you. For the record, Cora Parker from the Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management Division. A brief overview of the Procurement, Fleet, and Surplus Services Division budget. The 2003-05 governor's budget is $46.4 million total funds. That is a roughly 45% decrease from the legislatively approved level through the fifth special session. As Cam mentioned, though, that is largely a result of the transfer of the publishing and distribution unit to the Information Resource Management Division. Otherwise, their budget is really largely unchanged, except for the policy packages that we'll talk about in a few minutes. If you go to the next slide, you just see the breakout between the fund types, 70% other funds limited, and about 30% non-limited other funds.
Clark, question, Mr. Chair. Where would the sale of surplus property end up? Is that in other funds?
I believe that the Senator Winters, you will not see the revenue coming in on this picture, because this is simply the expenditure piece of it. But the expenditures associated that would, for the most part, be within the other funds limited category. There may be a small piece of that that's related in that non-limited category. I'm looking for confirmation. Mm-hmm. That's correct. So you'd have to look at a broader picture to see the revenue coming in. If you go, just talking briefly about the thoughts behind putting the budget together for this division. Again, the governor's budget is a substantial decrease because of the transfer of the publishing and distribution unit. Otherwise, it continues core functions, and it does include some packages for computer system maintenance. This is really actually bringing something on budget that was occurring before. But this is bringing it on budget, so sort of a truth in budgeting package, so to speak. And then legal sufficiency review costs, and Cam will talk about that in a moment. The next slide just shows the breakout of the different program units within the division. State Fleet is now the largest program unit within the division. Formerly, that was the publishing and distribution, took up the largest bulk of services here. Again, just break out by budget category, capital outlay 33%, personal services 27%, and then services and supplies 40%. That's across both limited and non-limited fund types. The budget began 2001-03. The legislatively adopted level was roughly $82 million. There was about $1 million reduction in other funds resulting from the second special session. Base budget adjustments include largely just roll-up of personnel actions and compensation changes, and essential packages, again, which Cam will detail in a moment, resulted in a reduction of just over $1 million. Policy packages, this unit does have four packages. Package 090 is a program reduction that, again, is eliminating a position that had been reduced as a result of the second special session. A little bit out of order here, but package 396, again, is related to computer maintenance costs. And, again, that is actually bringing something on budget that was done via revenue transfer to a different division before. So it's not actually additional funds being expended. It's simply bringing this on budget. So that's $708,598. Package 393, legal sufficiency costs. Cam will go into some detail there. That package is $400,000, however. And then 499 is the transfer of publishing and distribution. And you see roughly $44 million and 142 positions that are being transferred there. And as always, the technical adjustments for this division will be the same as the other divisions in DAS, and that's those related to the salary freeze and other position-related actions being considered right now.
Cam.
Mr. Chair, Cam Burney again. Procurement, Fleet, and Surplus Services. On to growth and reduction issues relating to each of the three programs within the division. First into Fleet Administration and Motor Pool. Note here that the Motor Pool, again, primarily through absorption of other agency fleets and consolidation, but somewhat from an expansion of demand, more vehicles needed, such as by corrections, taken the fleet size in the last late 80s to currently 1,700 to approximately 4,000. I might note, it's worth noting that how has FTE size grown or not grown with the growth of number of vehicles? For instance, in 1989, we had 42 FTE in the fleet. We had 1,700 vehicles. So if you look at it in terms of a vehicle per FTE, we had about 40 vehicles to be supported by each FTE. That number is now, or in 2001, the number is 60. We have 65 FTE and 3,875 vehicles in 2001. So it's a substantial increase in productivity of numbers of people managing the number of vehicles in service.
On to do you have any comparisons on your FTE versus what other states of similar size have in terms of not only your purchasing but also fleet administration? I don't know how much Senator Clarno got into that and her issue, but do you have any comparisons as to, or based on state budget, how many people they have doing procurement or surplus property, those kinds of things?
Configurations are different. In the state of Oregon, we have Motor Pool, but we have other agencies that manage their own fleets, whereas another state...
No, I understand. I understand that. I wondered if you had something on the shelf. If you don't, you don't. I don't know how at this late stage in the game we get some of those things. But.
Okay, into state and federal surplus property relating to growth and reduction. It's been sold since mid-90s. We've engaged in more and more intergovernmental agreements selling property in personal surplus property owned by political subdivisions, selling it on their behalf to our clients. We have our total customer base of folks who buy surplus property from us include over 2,250 state agencies, local governments, and certain nonprofits are qualified to buy off of price agreements.
Explain that, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I want to explain to you.
We're talking about organizations. All state and local government agencies are eligible to buy surplus property. In fact, by law, they get prioritized. They get first dibs on our property. Nonprofits are also able to buy surplus personal property. Ones that meet, in fact, there's some from Garten Foundation is an example of one is able to buy off of our price agreements surplus property. Another.
I must have asked the question wrong.
Okay.
I don't want the names. I want to know how you get qualified. What separates one not-for-profit from another?
I would be happy to provide you a list of the qualifications criteria.
I'm trying to think. Could a senior center, for example, that runs a little modest transportation program, and you're rotating a van out, how do they get in the queue to get the van?
We use the federal surplus standards here. The feds come up with them, and it's a list. I think this sounds like an eligible party, but I'd have to get you the standards so we can check with you and for you.
And then the logical follow-on is, if we use the federal standards and they seem to be exclusionary, we're not locked to those federal standards. How can we change it to make the senior centers eligible?
We are currently, statute has us locked to using those federal standards for both state and federal surplus property, so we would change the law.
Thank you.
Did you get there?
Yeah, God, it was a long forced march, but we got there.
Thanks, Senator Winters.
A couple of questions on surplus property, and I know we started it in 1990, and you say that you have 200-plus agencies that can access the surplus property. Is it accurate that after you can't sell it to the agency, then it goes on the public market? Is that the next step in that equation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, the first step, state government, local government, qualified nonprofits, and then anybody, the general public.
because we've had to expand our warehouse capability in order to accommodate the federal surplus and all the surplus property that we're now currently holding. Over time, can you give me whether or not it has cost, whether or not we are receiving increased revenue as a result of us getting into where we become the distributor and seller for surplus property for the federal government and other agencies? You know, I think there's probably some historical data that what we did prior to 90 and forward, that's one piece for me.
Can you look into getting that?
Can you get that for us?
Yes, yes, you have to.
And by the way, there is some good stuff out there. I went out there and bought some items for my office, and I one agency that we don't have control of. Some agencies turn in some.
Maybe we should take a field trip out there. We should have Representative Butler.
You should
take a field trip. Take a shopping trip.
Shopping trip out there to surplus property.
I'll bring up my pickup next week.
Mr. Chair and members, if you're interested, I can show each of you what significant properties have been purchased by political subdivisions in your districts.
That'd be great.
From the surplus property.
And the other thing that would be helpful, how rapidly do you sell off the computers? I saw an awful lot of computers out there when I went out shopping that were sitting on the shelf.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, one of the answers to that is that we receive many inoperable computers from agencies, and we hold those in abeyance because we're trying to obey federal laws and state laws related to the
proposal.
We don't sell them. We sell them only to certain sites, not to the general public. So I can I'll provide that in a written response.
Was there one time we were giving them to schools?
We are obliged to a law passed, I believe, two sessions ago or three sessions ago that obliged us to make these computers available to education service districts or high schools. And in fact, we had a contract with an organization that's affiliated with a major education service district in Washington County, I believe, called Strut, and I'm not sure what Strut stands for. Strut took many of our computers, refurbished them, and distributed them to ESDs in high schools.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
Everyone's raising their hands now. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't help but look at Mr. Hazelwood in the back of the room and keep thinking about seniors. There are many senior centers that are trying to teach seniors how to use computers. They don't need a great deal of computing power. They're just learning basic computer functions, and I'd like to figure out how to include senior centers, if it means changing the law, we'd draft a bill. But some of the stuff that a school wouldn't touch because it's not adequately powerful, senior centers would think were just great.
Representative Johnson, they're probably the highest users of computers. It's not just basic skills they're learning. Trust me,
if you talk to Charter Communications or any of those people, because I'm in the retirement business, they get more sophisticated questions from seniors than they do anyone else. Mr. Devlin.
I just wanted to state for the record that the Strut program in Washington County is actually, I believe, headquartered in the Tigard-Tualatin School District, and it's actually a vocational ed program at Tigard High. And I just wanted to put in a plug here, because within the education budget and within the ESD budget, there's a small line item for continuing support for that program. So we're just going to put that plug in there for the other members.
Thank you, Senator.
Very small item.
Thank you, Senator Devlin.
We appreciate that.
I do have a question while we're on surplus property or other property, and maybe this goes into procurement as well. Are state agencies really utilizing the surplus property? I mean, from other agencies, what percentage of your items that are put into surplus? Do you have a break? You don't have to tell me now, but can you give us a breakout maybe of the property that you bring in? What percent goes out to state agencies? What percent goes to local government? What percent goes to the public? And what percent do we have to haul off to the dump? I mean, my idea with the legislature was, and we went round and round with the IT stuff, is we come in every 2 years and get in, you know, we come in every 2 years, but they keep our computer, as Senator Devlin said, for, you know, we have a computer sitting here most of the time for 4 years. It's used for 6 months. I mean, my idea last session was to purchase those computers and then sell them at some discounted price to a state agency or whatever after you've collapsed them down, because they're still modern computers, and roll them out. So I'd like to ask to look at that, if you could, to see if there's a possibility to
to recycle those. So we're, you know, so that way the legislature's dealing with new computers, but we're getting a utility every biennium out of them instead of them sitting in a lot of people's offices. Though I know a lot of legislators do take them home as well. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other question that I guess I'd like to pursue with this is to what degree are state agencies forced to come and shop surplus first? Whether or not there's any opportunity for folks that are looking at new furniture to know that the checkoff order is you come out to surplus first time around and you'd have to justify buying new if it wasn't there. The state agency that I ran, that was our first stop shopping only because that was all we could afford. But you hear stories of agencies out buying all kinds of fancy stuff, and they've never darkened the door at surplus.
Right now, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we don't. We know of no policy like that, nor do we impose one like that. It's an individual agency thing, and we have some regular customers from state agencies. But back to a previous question, we provide most of the property, very little property is acquired by state agencies in the overall mix of things. Local governments are much heavier users than some nonprofits. But we saw a big change in the buying patterns after Measure 5 passed. And it turned into a booming industry where surplus property was much, much more used.
Representative Johnson.
One last question. As you're turning it into a booming industry, could you give us some assurance that you're able to turn this into a profit center? And maybe that's the wrong word to use, but given that it's a booming industry, I'd like to see the activities contributing to the bottom line of running the whole show rather substantially, rather than having it be seen as the bargain basement discount where stuff's ostensibly given away.
With the stock prices of Value Village and all these other people who are doing that nationally and the proliferation of that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Representative Johnson, a new reality has come upon us, and it's called eBay, where nearly all the property we make available, after local governments and state governments have not chosen to purchase it, we sell through eBay. And the pricing is as high as 250% higher in some commodities, vehicles typically 40 to 50% higher. So we're getting much, much higher proceeds and is money that's turned back to the agencies. So eBay, we were the first state to be involved in eBay, and we've made it a smashing success.
Cool.
Representative Winter. Senator Winter.
And I think that's very, very good. But I want to go back and follow with Representative Johnson's comments and would ask, and I think I asked earlier, that you give us information that talks about the growth, the profitability of it, you know, whether it's costing us more to warehouse and expand, whether or not we're actually paying for the surplus operation, and are we making a little profit. You know, I'd like to have a broader view of what's happening with surplus property. I think it's wonderful that we can put things on eBay and the public can access and purchase it. And I think it's wonderful that we're having federal surplus property and other properties that we can distribute or sell to nonprofits and others. But my concern is whether or not, even though we're in this business, whether this business is paying for itself, just what's going on in that environment, as well as I'd like to know how many other schools are accessing Strut, those computers. Because when I went out there, we're to the rafters with computers out there. And I was of the understanding that the schools, we're accessing that and they were using them in classrooms and what have you. If that's not true, we only have one school or two schools that's doing it. Maybe we need to do something with our ESDs and others to try to get that or add on seniors or whatever. But for us to have stored that kind of volume that isn't moving, it is troublesome to me.
Mr. Chairman, if I could offer one other thing, I think it'd be helpful for Cam to give you, and that is what's the source of our property, so you can see how much comes from the federal government, how much actually does come in from state agencies, how much comes to us from SAFE, and, you know, because we get it from a lot of different places, and I think that would be helpful you to see. And secondly, I want the record to reflect that I bought a desk and a credenza yesterday for $100 from Surplus Property, which is pretty nice. And they will send you pictures by email. I mean, I just had to call your call out and said, you know, we're trying to outfit an office. They sent me pictures for 2 days. I found a picture, called them, and they said, all right, it's $50 for the desk and $50 for the credenza. And
Rep. St. Patrick, I got a better deal. Mine was $70.
Okay. Leading by example.
Representative Winters, we know that you are more fiscally conservative. No. We appreciate, Director, we appreciate you setting the tone for the entire state government. By utilizing that, we'll put out the commercial. We'll be cutting the commercial shortly.
The other thing, Mr. Chairman,
is the week's winner show.
Yeah, the week's winner show.
We shouldn't overlook Oregon Correction Industries too when we talk about where agencies should be looking. I mean, the surplus properties are one thing, but we produce a lot of office furniture that agencies can and do buy through correctional. I don't know if they still call it Correction Industries now.
Oregon Correctional Enterprises.
Oregon Correctional Enterprises. And there's a lot of volume there, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, too.
Thank you, Director. We appreciate it. And you'll be getting us some information on surplus property.
Gary brought up one of source. I think that's very important.
I think we should bring your husband in here to talk about your shopping habits, Senator Winters.
I shop very economically.
All right,
I'm witness to that.
Brought up source, and I think that's very important because not all this equipment comes from agencies that DAS has control over, nor does this body control. And some of it is relatively new and good stuff. Shall remain unnamed.
Thanks, Cam.
And Senator Winters, we'll come up with a report. And just so you know, we are a self-supporting operation. There's no general fund support. So.
And a good profit center.
Yes. On to the next page. The Office of State Procurement. We're in the midst of a transition where we had more of our. We hit agencies a little harder in past biennial with assessments. We varied the new methods of bringing in revenue, including such things as vendor-collected administrative fees, which helps offset assessments and doesn't hit the agency as directly as before. We have a notable expansion of interagency and intergovernmental agreements. You can see here how many we have with local governments through this Oregon Cooperative Purchasing Program. We've expanded tremendously, and we'll get to this when we talk about the budget note from last session relating to how we've used new positions. We've engaged very heartily and actively in the creation and activation of a training and certification program. In fact, we've had 42 purchasing officials and state agencies certified since the beginning of 2002. Certification is no easy thing. After we come up with the curriculum, we come up with the testing, we coordinate with the Mexico Community College, and soon we hope to be able to make this available for local governments and their purchasing officials, so we have a standardization here. Talk somewhat about the Western States Contracting Alliance already to past chair, Representative Patridge, and welcome Representative Butler.
Thank you very much. Apologize for my tardiness today.
On page 20.
I explained that you were being a super sleuth. I appreciate it. Apologize. Go right ahead, please.
Sure. We're on page 25.
Yes, sir.
We've talked about Western States Contracting Alliance being this is a step beyond our state agency cooperative price agreements. This is many, many states coming together. And we're also talking about, as far as products and services and disabled program, the so-called QRFs. And these are Oregon programs to support contracts with qualified rehabilitation facilities. Increased number of high-volume purchases. And we'll get to that in our program measure at the end. And again, increasing use of sustainably sensitive purchasing specifications. We were identified as being a big player in the Governor Kitzhaber's executive order on sustainability, asked to come up with, for major product areas, sustainable specifications. And we put those in line, and the resulting bids are what we're getting back are indeed much more sustainable product lines from the bidders. Through our mandates. Next page, performance measures relating to the fleet administration and motor pool. Need to make reference here to, I believe, the study that Dallas has handed out to you. But largely, cost comparisons have been made, and in our most recent biennial evaluation of the fleet that's mandated by statute, we had a comparison performed between the motor pool vehicles and private sector vehicles using federal criteria. These are called Office Management Budget Criteria from Circular A76. And the Senator Clarno-led task force this last interim on state-owned vehicle efficiency used these criteria, Mr. Chair, as guided by a consultant, a national transportation consultant, Maximus Incorporated, to examine motor pool effectiveness in accordance with these criteria. As a major measure, we have noted here, and I might bring Mr. Petty up here to join me, that motor pool, by 2005, motor pool costs are projected to be 5% below those available through private sector providers. Right now, they're significantly below that.
Get closer to the mic, please.
Chairman, my name is Dugan Petty. I'm the Deputy Administrator with the Division.
The performance measure does reflect that the target for 2005 would be within 5% of contract pricing. Right now, our analysis is that it's 44% of contract pricing. Let me tell you a little bit about how we got to that analysis. We used the A76 analysis that the Office of Management and Budget Circular A76 analysis that the consultant provided us. And what that did was it identified allowable costs and non-allowable costs, those costs that would go away if you were to outsource something were considered to be the cost. Because if you were going to contract out for something, then some costs would go away from state agencies. There are some costs like overhead, some portion of CAM's salary, some portion of CORA's salary, some portion of the director's salary that are program costs that wouldn't go away. So those were taken out. Essentially, that's what that A76 analysis does. It takes that out. So we looked at those costs that would go away, and we figured out what the rentals were over those total costs for both the permanently assigned fleet and the day fleet, and we simply divided those day rentals into that total overall cost to get a rate. We compared those rates to what our current contract rates would be for those same number of trips. Based on that, the baseline in the performance measure is currently our prices are 44% of what the contract price would be. So they're much cheaper in-house versus those current contract prices. So we're in the process, in fact, this week, we anticipate towards the end of the week, of putting out another bid that will augment, at least for the day trip operation, the use of vehicles. We believe that that the best operating balance for that program is to have the right mix of private rentals and state-owned so that we're operating at the optimal lowest cost to the state. And to do that, we have to get rid of some of our state-owned vehicles and rent more private-owned vehicles so that we're not having a lot of vehicles in queue that don't get fully utilized that are state-owned that we're paying on. So with this bid that we anticipate awarding, we would expect that those prices will get closer. We don't know where they're going to be, but our target is to be at least 5% under those contract prices. We may be well under that.
So presently, are there privately leased vehicles in the fleet?
Presently, we have contracts for long-term rentals, which are used but not very frequently, and the pricing is not competitive with our rates. And then we also have a short-term rental contract for 30 days and under. And those prices are more competitive, but they're used by agencies if we had an overflow. We think there's a better contractual structure to put in place that will drive those prices down some and fit into the augment our state-owned vehicles.
I've got
I apologize. I did not bring my my circular down, that study down. I guess my concern is that what you're telling us, Dugan, is that in order to arrive at the number that is the bottom line cost for a state vehicle, what you do when you tally up all of your expenses that go into that, then you're backing out what you consider to be fixed overhead.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. What relationship is that fixed overhead the relationship to the total expenses? I'm sorry, I don't have my copy of that with me.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that off the top of my head either, but we can provide that to you shortly.
It'd be interesting to know from a private rental operation versus a public rental operation and other public rental operations, public state or local carpools, what they determine to be their percentage of the fixed overhead is, to see if ours is a greater percentage, because obviously if ours was a greater percentage of fixed overhead that has to be backed out, then that's going to look real inexpensive. Pretty soon you just get down to gas and oil and tires and nuts and bolts, and it's all darn cheap to drive one of the state's car if you can back a lot of overhead out. So that's my concern, is that ratio be in relationship to the other motor pools of fixed overhead.
Mr. Chairman, I think I understand. We'll provide you that information.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope my memory is correct here. In 97, there was motor pool issues that have been around the legislature, I think, for just about forever. But in 97, there was a bill that originated in the House and I believe passed the Senate also, that required agencies to possess themselves of portions of their fleet that were underutilized. How was that bill implemented? I believe it did pass, and I believe it was signed by the governor.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, that bill, House Bill 3705, did pass both houses. It required agencies, it related to sedans and station wagons owned by state agencies. And it noted that any senior state agency that failed to achieve over a six-month period a predetermined, pre-announced threshold mileage was to be surrendered. And the director of the Department of Administrative Services was to basically see to it, and this wasn't just for motor pool cars, this is for all state agencies that had sedans and station wagons. The result, and we had to come up with, and we did submit a report to the legislature as required by that bill. The first year it was out, and noted that how many vehicles were turned in. Some vehicles were sold. Other vehicles were provided to those who were in the queue, in the waiting list, to get vehicles, and we only reassigned them if we had guarantees that utilization would indeed be high. So that bill is still being monitored, still being every year we have an evaluation, and every year some vehicles are taken in, taken back, and some are sold, and some are reassigned. So the overall effect is higher utilization, higher mileage utilization, because that's what the bill talked about. And one of
the original bill was, Mr. Chairman, the original bill had a fatal flaw in it, to be honest. The original bill actually basically said that if an individual vehicle was not driven by an individual employee a certain number of miles, then that vehicle could no longer be retained. And the bill ultimately was modified to say, you know, that a vehicle could be retained if it had multiple users that got up to a certain mileage range. Because what we got into was, in many cases, well, it's not true for all state agencies. In many cases, we found that it was preferable, particularly in the area of services to children and families, to be using state vehicles versus using employee vehicles because of potential liability issues. But it's interesting that this issue never really goes away. I think we spent weeks on the issue in terms of hearings in 97 on it.
Just thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, the bill does allow the department, the head of the Department of Administrative Services, to make exceptions. The agency comes forward and saying, there's no other alternative. We even though we don't drive this number of miles, we're down here, we have a business reason why we need it. And the DAS director may say, go ahead, gives them the power of exception.
Thank you.
This is a snapshot of of current note relating to, based upon, I believe, 1,000 miles driven a month in a vehicle, a typical sedan, what are the overall costs to customers? And Oregon fares very well compared to California and to Washington. Incidentally, the Federal General Services Administration has a number that's 38 cents a mile. That's below us, and it makes us think, how can we do better here? They do have advantages in the General Services Administration buying cars directly from the manufacturer. I think I've discussed this issue before with prior Ways and Means subcommittees, do not sell directly to state agencies and local governments. So we get vehicles through Oregon providers. Most of our servicing is done. We do not that much. We do simple service in-house, but most of it is contracted out throughout Oregon. We had a procurement measure, and I can again ask Duke and Petty to come forward and talk about this. But this is one of our key measures for the division, and we've talked about this already. Estimated savings resulting from high volume price agreements compared to prices that would be paid by state agencies without availability, without access to these price agreements. And we've engaged in some exhaustive historical analysis relating to five specific areas, and we'll keep revisiting these and revisiting you with the numbers relating to these successes in this area. But basically, the percentage, which for 2002 was 7.4%, is projected to go to 7.6, and you're saying, that doesn't mean anything, that's not enough. But when you hear what Dugan Petty might have to say in terms of what they amount to in real dollars and how much agencies save, it's an eye-opener.
This measure is really trying to get after the effectiveness in what is the value that a central purchasing organization can add to the organization. So we've tried to say, how do we measure that? What's the best way to measure that? And we think the best way to measure it is to look at a market basket of typical things that people would buy. And so what we've done here is we've gone back and we've looked at purchases of standard vehicles, computers, office supplies, industrial paper, cell phones, which are pretty typical indicators of the kinds of things that the state would buy. And we've said, okay, what do we pay for these? And what are other comparable organizations paying for, so we can see how we measure up, how effective we are? Part of what we want our folks to be doing is that before we sign a contract, after we've ran a competitive process, we want to know that we're really getting good value. And if we're not, then we ought to ask ourselves, why not, and should we even make this award? So we think if we start measuring these five items, it's going to give us a pretty interesting market basket. The comparators that we're looking against to benchmark are, in vehicles, it's GSA in Washington State. In personal computers, we've looked at government pricing discounts that would be available from the manufacturer's government pricing. Office supplies, we benchmarked against GSA, U.S. Communities, which is a cooperative buying organization that counties belong to, and local shelf prices. Cell phones, we've looked at GSA, other rate plans, government pricing, and an industrial paper, we've looked at Idaho, Washington, and U.S. Communities, that cooperative buying organization.
Senator Leonard is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In addition to looking at the cost and whether or not we're saving and getting the most competitive prices. Do you also have the information of whether the companies that we're purchasing from are in Oregon? I guess I'm getting a little sensitive to our own economic development and our own issue of the economies. And can you provide that to us?
Yes, Madam, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, Senator Winters, yes, we can. I can tell you that these benchmarks for vehicles, for example, there are all through local dealers. Computers are not, because we're buying directly from the manufacturer, which is typical of the industry. It's hard for us to do anything else these days. Office supplies is with Boise Cascade, and while they are local, they are also in many other states, so there are some different presence, but we can get you some more detailed information about
how that breaks down.
Follow up, Sandra.
But in addition to the larger volume, the smaller items, sometimes with small businesses, they're going after the little smaller contracts and not so much the larger ones. If you could give us some kind of percentage breakout of how much of that is going to our little, you know, to the entrepreneurs into the state versus those that are out of state.
Chairman, Senator Winters, we will provide your report.
Thank you.
I think relative to the issue of Boise Corporation, Boise, of all of the states that it does business in, pays more income tax to the state of Oregon than it does in any other state in which it is qualified to do business in the United States. And that's largely as a result, I think, of the rather substantial penetration that Boise Corporation has in the office supply business with governmental agencies. That having been said, I do have a concern. I guess what you're telling me then, Dugan, is that I should be able to go downstairs off of the office supply table downstairs and pick up a ream of paper as cheaply as I could go down and pick it up at one of the supply stores. And I know that isn't the case. So I'm concerned about the fact that we're telling our employees this is always cheaper when we pick it up off of the state supply shelf. And it ain't so. And that is a concern to me. I appreciate the fact that, you know, that the other folks, you know, sell to 1,000 people and in a state supply, you might have 1,000 employees, but it's all within the same agency. So that is a concern. And I have had constituents that have been somewhat concerned, state and government employees. An ODOT employee contacted me a number of months ago and said, you know, have you looked at the state procurement book for a desk? This particular person that was working in one of the ODOT offices said, you know, I could see the same desk for about a third less money on the showroom floor down at the local office supply house, and I had no choice but to buy it from the state book, and ODOT paid a third more money for it. And I said, you know, I guess we must make it up in volume or something. I'm not sure where we're doing that at.
Mr. Chairman, I share your concern about that, and it's always difficult to sort out whether you have a loss leader where we're getting good fair pricing, but yet there's a loss leader someplace and some volume. This desk situation certainly doesn't sound like that, and I think part of that is beginning to measure our performance in terms of let's take a realistic look in the marketplace and see what this stuff is going for. Because if, in fact, we're paying 12% more than what you can buy that desk off the showroom for, and it's exactly the same thing, we need to be saying, what are we bringing to the party? Maybe we're not adding value, and if we can't drive pricing, then maybe we shouldn't be in the middle of that. We should free that up. So some of it, this measure, I think, is important for us to begin to get there and to be accountable back to with comparators to other similar organizations that are buying similar things with the same buying power.
I guess there's a little bit of degree of common sense in the whole process too, and that is when they were shutting down the bridges for lack of ability to carry trucks, before they could get the sign people out, they needed some sign and some stencils and so forth to put out some butcher paper to say this road closed to big trucks. And they were told, you can't go down to the local office supply store, you got to order it from Salem. And so my constituents in Vail and Burns happened to not be able to notify with butcher paper across the road to say the bridges are closed from here on through to Salem because of the overweight issues on the rivers and so forth. And we had to wait to order the supplies. Couldn't order them from the local supply store in Burns. Couldn't go down and pick them up unless you wanted to do so out of your own pocket. And that's a concern. I mean, if the supplies are emergency supplies and not on hand, I don't care whether they're 10 cents cheaper. It looked like to me that it was a situation where they shouldn't have had to have been obligated to order one of a piece of butcher paper this big and one grease pen this long. I would hope that there's some common sense and rationale in local purchasing options.
Mr. Chairman, I would agree with you. We will go back and look at our policy that's set up in that contract around that, and if there's anything in there that would direct that, we will have that change. I would be surprised at that. And I would agree with you that when we're buying, we ought to be exercising common sense. And we would hope that agencies who run into that kind of problem would get back to us and change that. But
thank you.
You're correct.
Please.
Mr. Chairman, just a curiosity question, because I know I'm in the business. We know when certain commodities are at a price to where we can buy in volume that unless I'm talking about now, pork, you know, we know the cycle. Is there the same kind of cycle with merchandise that you purchase that, you know, there are times when it's more advantageous for you to purchase than other times?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, you're exactly right. It depends on the commodities. Commodities tend to operate like that. Paper, for example, and for printing and distribution, for example, they go out to bid and they do bulk buying because paper prices will fluctuate. Now, if they're about out, they won't have any choice, but the extent that they can hit the time to market,
warehouses are full.
They will do that. It is a little hard for us in central purchasing, given our staffing level, to do timing buys against the commodity. And many of the sorts of things that we buy, like office supplies, don't have those cycles. But true commodities do, and that would be the way to go about buying that.
Senator Devlin's recognized.
A question out of curiosity. In terms of purchases of vehicles, and you're purchasing, obviously you said, from vendors in the state, have you had any experience with getting lower prices on vehicles in the end of model years in terms of, you know, out on the market outside, people don't want to buy at the end of the market year because their car is already a year old by the time that they purchase it. But it probably doesn't really matter to the state. You're going to use it for 80 or 100,000 miles. You're not particularly concerned about what the resale value of it is after 100,000 miles. But has there been any experience with that in terms of purchasing vehicles?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, in vehicle purchases, because of the volumes that we buy, and because of lead time and ordering times, we enter that market with the invitation to bid. And so we're not necessarily able to time that cycle. We will find, though, that at times, rather than rebid or renew, we look at what's going on in the marketplace and we can exercise some strategic buying by renewing at good pricing to avoid a price coming up. But it's hard to time vehicle buys based on those kind of more minute-by-minute fluctuation in the market. Given the volume we have, we'd have to have more dedicated resources to be nothing other than auto buyers.
You got to be the right color, too.
I might add on that, Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, if I could, is that we, by and large, think we get pretty good pricing from the local dealers on the automobiles. We buy a substantial amount, and we buy somewhere for state agencies, somewhere in the neighborhood of 45%. There is in the neighborhood of 55 to 60% of those total volume of purchases are by counties and cities and political subdivisions, so they're able to buy off of our contracts.
Follow up.
It's a related question too. In the study that was done, recommended keeping vehicles to 100,000 miles. I'm not saying that resale value is that significant of an issue, but are you having? Well, when you're at your average now is 80,000 miles, at least that's what it said in the study, when you get rid of a vehicle. When you go to 100,000 miles, how much of an anticipated drop are you going to get in terms of returns from the resale of those vehicles? Do you have any idea? Or?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, I couldn't. There is a percentage drop, but I couldn't tell you. I couldn't quantify that. We know that the more miles put on the vehicles, and the consultants verified that, then the less residual value they have, it's we kind of depreciate them on a straight line. And on top of that, the further out they get in terms of aging, then their operating costs increases with those vehicles as well. But I can't tell you exactly what the percentage.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up.
Please follow up.
And I don't know if. Thank you. I don't know if anything's changed in terms of this. When we looked at this in 97, I mean, there are vehicles that are used extensively, relatively high mileage, but the averages for state vehicles were relatively on the low side. So a 100,000-mile vehicle, I don't know what that would, on your average, that might relate to a vehicle that's almost a decade old before you actually get rid of it.
Senator Devlin, you're correct. It's not there's such because there's such varying usage of the amounts of vehicles. It could be 10 years old, but, you know, but depending on if it's an inspector for Bowley, it could be 4 years old.
Representative Johnson had a question.
No, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Thank you. Onto page 29, essential packages. Cora noted these in her review relating to two essential packages, 010 and 030, what the adjustments are in these areas and the respective amounts added. Budget reduction package, just to note to the subcommittee that as a result of action taken during the second special session, there was a reduction at the Medford Bay surplus property program, which is that operation has since been closed down. We're doing it all out of our Salem operation now. So that's an economy move. Enhancement packages. Don't go away, dude.
Mr. Chair, just a question.
Yes, Representative Patrick.
Do our surplus operations pay for themselves? I mean, do you get a... So I guess I'm wondering, when you close down the Medford facility, if it pays for itself, why that's particularly a savings?
Mr. Dukin can give me a nudge if I'm not heading in the wrong direction, but the Metro operation, Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, is not paying for itself.
Okay. That's fair.
Yep.
Thank you.
Okay. On to enhancement packages. The first package, 393, legal sufficiency review, $400,000. Mr. Chair, this relates almost exclusively to the Office of State Procurement, where since enactment, I believe, two sessions ago of a bill relating to a Department of Justice bill that increased the breadth of legal sufficiency reviews of state contracts, reviewing many more types of contracts than previously, and this involved a review of contracts that come through us as well as individual agencies. We have been hit with increasingly higher amounts of legal sufficiency review costs, outpacing what we had put in place for the budget, legislatively approved budget. It's always, the realized amount has always been exceeded.
Representative Patridge is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Butler sits on my committee, and we've been discussing, and we're going to maybe do a survey of state agencies like DAS as to the Attorney General's contracts that they're giving you. I'm wondering if you guys are using pretty standard boilerplate contracts. Are you happy with the training on those people? Those kinds of things. So you're going to have to reveal those things on it. We're going to have an anonymous survey that goes out, but. I just want to. We're looking at some of those things. My understanding is from hearing from the various people that I know around in various agencies that there may be some improvements here. And so I'm wondering what kind of impacts or things that could be done at the Attorney General's office that could compress our costs down a little bit.
President Johnson's recognized.
Let me take one step beyond that, and I'm delighted to hear you say that you're going to be looking at it. We have a $400,000 package here for legal sufficiency review, and I'm trying to understand what kind of contracts are going to get reviewed. and that was originally my question. After Representative Patridge's remarks, I guess I have a larger question that I would pose to Mr. Weeks. In the terms of DAS's guidance to agencies in general on legal sufficiency review, I have been made aware and had personal dealings with two contracts that emanated out of OECDD's activities. One of them was so poorly written that it was unenforceable and ended up costing the state $500,000. The other one was so poorly drafted that it ended up costing a local special district $419,000. And so I'm trying to get a sense, and maybe you can't answer this now, and I'm saying this as much for my colleagues' information as they undertake their review. How sometimes you've got the AG looking at the silliest contracts that are kind of no-brainers, and then these much larger contracts that end up being legally unenforceable pass through with virtually no review. And I'm trying to at least set for your consideration as the chief operating officer giving guidance to agencies against the context of all of the costs associated with AG legal sufficiency reviews. Who's looking at what contracts, and where are agencies required to bring contracts for legal sufficiency review, and when aren't they? And that's so global a question, I don't really expect you to have an answer. I'm just raising it as an issue.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I can't imagine contracts for $500,000 that didn't get AG review, because any contract of that size would have, under any process we have, required an AG review. So if I understood you correctly...
Let me quickly tell you what it was, just so you know. A grant was given to a company that produces a special kind of landing equipment. And the deal in the contract was that in exchange for $500,000 in general fund, the company would provide to the state of Oregon one of these systems to be used at a rural airport. And when I was the aeronautics director, I went to the company and said the state of Oregon would like its system, and moreover, we'd like a system with at least the best warranty that you would give your best commercial customers. And I was told to kiss off. So I went to the AG and said, enforce this contract. The state is owed this piece of equipment, and on behalf of the airports, I want it. And after being deflected many times by OECDD, and this isn't a time long ago in a land far away, I don't want to cast aspersions on the current operation, finally it was revealed that the contract was unenforceable. And so drifting around now is the loss of a very valuable piece of equipment that has gotten the investment of $6 million in federal R&D. The state stepped up and helped make this possible. I believe that the state of Oregon was owed the equipment and could never get it because the contract was unenforceable. I just found that absolutely mystifying.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I would have found it exactly the same way, but it doesn't get my. I guess my more fundamental question is: what did the AG review the contract before it was, or the grant agreement before it was released? And if they did, then we have questions with the Justice Department about why would a contract have been unenforceable. But I want to make clear that any contracts of that size have to be reviewed by the AG. We don't permit agencies to go out and issue $500,000 contracts without any kind of legal review. So,
well, and that was my experience. We don't need to beat this to death, but for my two colleagues who are going to be asking for AG sufficiency, and again, I will readily admit this is a five-year-old story, but it still seems to me that the citizens of the state of Oregon are out $500,000 and everybody over the department just sort of went, nah, things happen. That's a problem.
It's a problem. Yes, ma'am.
Senator Winters, recognized.
Thank you. Just a couple of added items to that. And one is that I'm glad to hear, Rob, that you're going to be doing that. But in addition, as you look at boilerplates, what is the dollar limit of which you have to go to the AG's office for efficiencies? But in addition, there appears, and just following up on Representative Johnson, there isn't any penalty or any recourse with the AG's office when they commit the professional error.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that somehow, as we talk about this, the agencies are bound, but are required to go to the AG's office for the efficiency review. They're required to seek their counsel and advice, but when the AG's office does not, in fact, give them, quote, the sound advice, in the case of what happened to Representative Johnson, they can just say, bug off. It seems to me that you can't continue the bug-off pattern either. Agencies still have to pay that hourly rate for the services that they did not receive. So I would hope, as you're looking at boilerplate contracts and that you're looking at this efficiency question, that we also include in that the question of when they don't do their due diligence that we have paid for, that somehow there has to be some kind of a remedy back to the agency.
Stripes out of their back, would that be sufficient?
I don't know, but you know, yes, something. A belt or two.
I'm just trying to clarify something here in terms of, and also the work that Representative Patridge and Representative Butler are trying to do on this, is that if my memory is correct, part of the reason the AG inserted themselves to be more involved in this was, one, of agencies entering into contracts that were not well written. Two, of agencies developing in-house counsels or levels of in-house counsel, and I don't know if there's been any evidence that that's disappeared or if it's even an issue anymore. And the other thing was agencies contracting for outside counsel, and so that work would be done. So I was hoping that any review would be broad in terms of looking at all those issues. And I know that there was a concern, and I might check, since you're doing a survey with some of the people at the Oregon Department of Transportation, there was a concern at one time that because of the amount of time, at least when this originally went into place, that the AG was going to be reviewing everything, of delay in contracts on transportation projects and the impact that that actually had in terms of delays in transportation projects cost money, particularly if you missed part of a construction season because of the delay. But I think part of the emphasis of all of this was to save costs originally. That was the original idea. And so it'd be interesting to see what you get back.
Representative Patridge, I like the idea of the anonymity being in there. However, by the same token, the concern that I would have relative to certain portions of these contracts, I think 4 years ago when I had the OLCC before us and general government, one of the contacts that we had then was some concerns about the contracts which were being written, but they did not provide for the standard boilerplate language for agents, which would say you're not an employee of the state, and don't ever try to pretend that you are, because if you do and you prevail, then you will pay the costs. And that was something that I learned back when I was a county elected official, that we had that standard language in there. I asked then why the language wasn't in there. They said, check it out. I last asked 2 years ago why we were then being sued, I think, on three or four cases, and the language wasn't in at that time. And I asked if it was going to be put in, and they went back to the same group of folks that were their AG's representatives, and those were the folks that were doing the review, and they said, that's not a bad idea. We'll consider it sometime. So if we're going to do the legal sufficiency review, maybe it isn't the people within those departments who have been assigned to those departments should be doing that legal sufficiency review, because they've already been there. And I don't know. I guess if I was an employee whose job didn't depend upon it and whose salary wasn't diminished by a single penny, if the state was sued for millions and millions time after time, what incentive is there? And I look at the comments made by Senator Winters. Maybe there should be some, and I don't know how you do it. You take it out of the stripes of their back? I don't think so. But the concern I've got is that maybe the legal sufficiency review should be done by someone other than, maybe this is a spot where if we're going to have a legal sufficiency review, maybe it shouldn't be the AG's office that's doing it. Physician heal thyself? I don't think so. Maybe go to a specialist.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's
probably a conversation we should have with the AG. And but one of the things, and I want to harken back to Senator Devlin's earlier comments, agencies cannot contract for legal opinions outside the Attorney General's office. They may not do that. They also, while there are lots of attorneys, members of the bar working in agencies, they cannot offer legal advice to agency directors on any matter of law. I mean, they're prohibited from doing that. That doesn't mean they don't sit and, you know, say to the director, because I've had a lot of attorneys work for me, you don't really have to do this or you can do that and so on like that. But my advice and any agency's advice must come from the AGs. And I appreciate your and understand your concern about, you know, the AG who represents an agency actually doing the legal sufficiency review. But that's a matter for the AG, I think, because that's the way the AG runs it. We have a...
I didn't mean to open up this can of worms.
We have a state law firm. There's been more than one time as a regulator, when I regulated insurance companies like Safeco, would very much like to have had my own legal counsel. And I couldn't. I always felt that it was not appropriate to have the same law firm represent me and the person that I was trying to regulate or the industry I was trying to regulate, but that's the way we do it in Oregon right now. So I understand, and I'd be very happy to have further conversation.
Well, and I guess the allocation or the appropriation of $400,000 to go in and have the same people that said 2 years ago and 4 years ago, that might be a pretty good idea. You know, maybe one day we ought to check it out. If those folks are going to review for legal sufficiency the contracts themselves. In other words, the same people we've asked about these kinds of issues saying, Jimmy, it's the way I've always done it. They must be good. But the concern that I've got is now we're starting to buck up to some of those suits with no apparent difficulty for the person or consequences for the persons who have been basically giving the legal advice. Senator?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern is that any time you have an entity that is the sole source and you have no remedy outside of that sole source, and so that entity can, in fact, do as whatever, which is what we're hearing here, of saying bug off, and you just bug off and you still have to pay the legal bill because they're the legal agent for the agencies. There still should be some sort of remedy when they don't do what they're contracted to do. And, you know, the agency is paying the bill, and I just think, and it's a conversation maybe we need to have with the Attorney General's office, but for the attorneys that are out of that office to tell somebody, well, we didn't do it. I mean, you got socked for it, but that's just too bad, is not to me a valid, and I think those conversations need to be had. Because more and more, you know, and I know that the Attorney General's office is involved in almost every aspect of the agency. Whether we're talking about interpreting federal rules and regulations, you know, but they're beginning to involve themselves not only in contractual issues, but also in the issues in some respects of managing the agencies. And, you know, I'm beginning to have some real concern as to how broad the AG's involvement is with the agency. And they can go back to their office and say, I gave this advice, and if it works, fine. But if it doesn't, it doesn't, fine. And so I think there has to be some discussions with the AG's office as to when your staff or staff does not provide the kinds of services that is expected, that there should be some kind of remedy, just as we do with any other thing that happens in the legal field. So, Representative Patridge, I wish you well as you go down this line.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and proceed, Cam.
Chairman, I might add that, at least in the context of the State Purchasing Office legal sufficiency reviews, we're looking at all IT contracts over $75,000, contracts over $100,000. We submit our bids before we put them out on the street to the Department of Justice to do a review, which makes sense because you don't want to get ready to make the award only to find out that you have a problem. And then we have the contracts reviewed for legal sufficiency by the Department of Justice. On average, we're doing about 900 contracts a year that they're looking at. And I would say that in my tenure with the State Purchasing Office, we've not found that the results of those legal sufficiency reviews have left us in, not that contracts are trouble-free, because that's kind of the nature of the business, but we've not found that we've had a situation, as Representative Johnson has mentioned, that's certainly not to say that, that those don't exist elsewhere, but our experience is, has been that we have gotten, I think, sounder contracts. Now, whether or not that $400,000 is worth that $900,000 reviews is another question, but I think that there is being some value placed in that. The other thing I would just suggest in looking at our totals over time here, we went back and tracked our actual expenses with the Department of Justice. 95-97 biennium, we were paying $52,000 a year. In the 97-99 biennium, it went up to $189,000 a year, and that's the biennium in which the law change that required the legal sufficiency review began to kick in. Not the whole biennium, but a portion of it. Last biennium, 99-01, was the first full biennium of legal sufficiency reviews, and our actual expenditures during that biennium were $387,000. And then currently we're at $331,000 and projecting a $480,000 legal sufficiency review. And some of that is connected to increased volume. We're making more contract awards than we were. So,
Representative Patridge?
I just wonder how you chose the $75,000 amount. And I guess my question is, I would imagine a lot of your contracts are fairly...
By statute.
It's by statute. Okay. Cindy's going. And do you think that is... I mean, is that sufficient? Can you have boilerplate? Can you do something different than your...
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond to Representative Patrick's comment, I think that's a good comment. Right now, the Department of Justice has actually convened a group of agency people and themselves to look at these thresholds and to see if it's not time to make some adjustment in what those amounts are and the kinds of contracts to which a legal sufficiency review should take place.
Let me just say this. I think we asked this question a couple of years ago. And that was, would the legal sufficiency survey help us? And I believe the answer was the affirmative, that those departments and agencies within the state which go out and attempt to circumvent the whole contracting process by doing this business of delivering product A in 10 different deliveries of $49,000 a piece, I believe that you told us that was to circumvent that, because, and I haven't seen that continuing to happen from the ODF&W for the delivery of certain fish, warm water fish and those kinds of things, because they used to do that with some degree of frequency, that if you delivered on Tuesday, they were $49,000 worth, and Wednesday, $49,000 worth, Thursday, or you know, those kinds of things. If they were afternoon or evening delivered, then it circumvented the whole contracting issue. So, and I think I've gotten some satisfaction there. Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you provide us with, of your 900 contracts, what the dollar range is, the $75,000 to $100,000, and break it out
that
way.
Back to you.
Thank you.
So maybe the results of those reviews would be helpful too.
And the results of those reviews, thank you. The cost of those reviews.
Cost is the what, $400,000+ that you're anticipating?
My understanding, the AG bills you based on an hourly rate, so we should be able to determine how much they billed for those that are $75,000.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, on the same page, the bottom of the same page, package 396, CORA noted that is attempt to bring certain spending of funds for IRMD system support under the eyes of budget review, and that's the reason why this is here, $708,000. The major package in terms of dollars and positions, the transfer of the publishing distribution program to IRMD. In IRMD's budget presentation, they will tell you the details of receiving IRMD and how IRMD and publishing distribution are now working together. I understand that you've asked each division to comment on budget note to last session's budget bill relating to expects, I believe, something like the subcommittee expects improvements in central management capability, will be able to set and monitor high standards. I think I'm picking some of the words out of what the budget note is. We have here on page 33 and 34 some of the narrative that came from our purchasing people, as this is where this applied, relating to what we've done with the positions that we've been able to employ. Now, I should note that some positions we haven't been able to fill because of our AG cost problem, so we have lacked the cash to actually bring people into certain positions. So we had more activity, Mr. Chair, relating to the monitoring of delegations to agencies, more activity relating to training and certifying state agency contracting officials to make sure they're doing it the right way. I should note that I noted earlier on, I'm not sure if you were here, Mr. Chair, that we so far certified and 42 state procurement officers in basic contracting practices. So we've been very active in that area. One other budget note I might mention, it's not one that was assigned to us, but one that Representative Johnson is well aware of. It relates to the Aviation Task Force, and DAS was a member of that task force and have worked in hand with other agencies that own aircraft.
Thank you.
And on to the last slide relating to vacancies. We do have, as noted here, 18 agencies. Some are in recruitment and some are frozen. And indeed, some of the folks, some of the positions are assigned to the procurement program that we're still waiting to have cash flow be realized so we can launch those positions. And we're subject to the freezing of positions, too.
Representative Johnson's recognized.
Kev, help me understand why, if you've got auto mechanic and laborers in recruitment, and those are also listed as frozen positions, and I thought we were only supposed to be involved in hiring where health and safety were involved, how does that work?
Well, I'll come back with specifics unless, Dugan, do you have any information there? I would have to provide you with the specifics on that, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, these are positions that aren't necessarily in the recruitment process. I think that might be these are positions that have simply not been able to be recruited for some period of time. There's been some vacancy around that.
Still don't understand. Because you've got 8 are recruitment, which would strike me as either they can't be recruited, and I just find it inconceivable that in this labor market you couldn't recruit a laborer. And 10 positions that are frozen, and if you've got the same category in both those that are subject to recruitment and those that are frozen, auto mechanic and laborer, I don't understand how that works.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I don't know the details of these specific positions, and as Cam mentioned, he'll get those for you. But to give an example, and I'm guessing here, so don't count this as factual, but one of the other items on the hiring freeze list was if it would impact a program detrimentally, so it would eliminate the program or something without that actually having been an intended consequence of a legislative decision or otherwise.
So without a car, a child care worker couldn't drive to the visitation, and without the labor or the auto mechanic, you can't make the car work.
That is possibly a link, or if this happened to be in the Springfield facility, for example, where there are only like 2 or 3, help me out here, people who work that facility, and if a position is not recruited for, then you can't keep the facility going. So those are examples, again, I'm guessing on the specifics, but
I'm willing to buy your guess right now, but I sure would like an answer. And I guess I just want to point out, for those of us that are trying to answer constituent questions about why certain things are happening, this slide seems to show a certain elasticity. A hiring freeze is a hiring freeze unless it's not, and somebody's making a subjective decision that it's not, and this is the sort of stuff that is part, in my view, of the acid drip of credibility, and I just would appreciate knowing
how this all comes together.
Senator Devlin's recognized.
Thank you. Along those same lines, just so, because I think it's going to be critical when we get into the later stages of considering these budgets, when we see something expressed like this, 8 are in recruitment, 10 positions are frozen, is that an indication that the 8 are in that when we see 8 are in recruitment, that those positions have been cleared to be filled in terms of outside the freeze, and that those other 10 positions are truly frozen and will remain frozen as long as the freeze stays in place?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, typically that is what that means. I don't want to speak to the specifics of this slide. I think Cam will go back and get some more detail for you on what these 8 positions are, whether or not they are, in fact, in recruitment and what point in recruitment and why they would have been accepted from the hiring freeze process. But typically that is how DAS has been reporting these to you.
Thank you. Let's see. At that particular point, we are back on schedule for Monday. And we're just one half a day behind schedule, I believe. So with that, we'll go ahead and gavel close today. Thank you very much for your excellent input and comments.